The Invasion of Venus. Stephen Baxter. For me, the saga of the Incoming was above all Edith Black's story, for she, more than anyone else I knew, was the one who had a problem with it. When the news was made public, I drove out of London to visit Edith at her country church. I had to cancel a dozen appointments to do it, including one with the Prime Minister's office. But I knew, as soon as I got out of the car and stood in the soft September rain, that it had been the right thing to do. Edith was pottering around outside the church, wearing overalls and rubber boots and wielding an alarming-looking industrial-strength jackhammer. But she had a radio blaring out a phone-in discussion, and indoors, out of the rain, I glimpsed a widescreen TV and laptop, both scrolling news, mostly fresh projections of where the Incoming's decelerating trajectory might deliver them, and new deep space images of their craft, if such it was, a massive block of ice like a comet nucleus, leaking very complex patterns of infrared radiation. Edith was plugged into the world, even out here in the wilds of Essex. She approached me with a grin, pushing back goggles under a hard hat. "Toby!" I got a kiss on the cheek and a brief hug. She smelled of machine oil. We were easy with each other physically. 15 years earlier, in our last year at college, we'd been lovers, briefly. It had finished with a kind of regretful embarrassment. Very English, said our American friends. But it had proven only a kind of speed bump in our relationship. Glad to see you, if surprised. I thought all you civil service types would be locked down in emergency meetings. For a decade, I'd been a civil servant in the Environment Ministry. No, but old Thorpe, my minister, has been in a continuous Cobra session for 24 hours. Much good it's doing anybody. I must say, it's not obvious to the layman what use an environment minister is when the aliens are coming. Well, among the scenarios they're discussing is some kind of attack from space. A lot of what we can dream up is similar to natural disasters. A meteor fall could be like a tsunami, a sunlight occlusion like a massive volcanic event. And so Thorpe is in the mix, along with health, energy, transport. Of course, we're in contact with other governments, NATO, the UN. The most urgent issue right now is whether to signal or not. She frowned. Why wouldn't you? Security. Edith, remember, we know absolutely nothing about these guys. What if our signal was interpreted as a threat? And there are tactical considerations. Any signal would give information to a potential enemy about our technical capabilities. It would also give away the very fact that we know they're here. She scoffed. Tactical considerations? Paranoid bullshit. And besides, I bet every kid with a CB radio is beaming out her heart to ET right now. The whole planet's alight. Well, that's true. You can't stop it. But still, sending some kind of signal authorized by government or an intergovernment agency is another step entirely. Oh, come on. You can't really believe anybody is going to cross the stars to harm us. What could they possibly want that would justify the cost of an interstellar mission? So we argued. I'd only been out of the car for 5 minutes. We'd had this kind of discussion all the way back to late nights in college, some of them in her bed, or mine. She'd always been drawn to the bigger issues. To the context, as she used to say. Though we'd both started out as math students, her head had soon expanded in the exotic intellectual air of the college, and she'd moved on to study older ways of thinking than the scientific. Older questions still unanswered. Was there a God? If so, or if not, what was the point of our existence? Why did we, or indeed anything, exist at all? In her later college years, she took theology options, but quickly burned through that discipline and was left unsatisfied. She was repelled, too, by the modern atheists, with their aggressive denials. So after college, she had started her own journey through life, a journey in search of answers. Now, of course, maybe some of those answers had come swimming in from the stars in search of her. This was why I'd felt drawn here, at this particular moment in my life. I needed her perspective. In the wan daylight, I could see the fine patina of lines around the mouth I used to kiss, and the strands of grey in her red hair. I was sure she suspected, rightly, that I knew more than I was telling her, more than had been released to the public. But she didn't follow that up for now. "Come see what I'm doing," she said, sharply breaking up the debate. "Watch your shoes." We walked across muddy grass towards the main door. The core of the old church dedicated to St. Cuthbert was a Saxon-era tower. The rest of the fabric was mostly Norman, but there had been an extensive restoration in Victorian times. Within was a lovely space, if cold, the stone walls resonating. It was still consecrated, Church of England, but in this empty agricultural countryside, it was one of a widespread string of churches united in a single parish, and rarely used. Edith had never joined any of the established religions, but she had appropriated some of their infrastructure, she liked to say. And here she had gathered a group of volunteers, wandering souls more or less like-minded. They worked to maintain the fabric of the church, and within she led her group through what you might think of as a mix of discussions, or prayers, or meditation, or yoga practices, whatever she could find that seemed to work. This was the way religions used to be before the big monotheistic creeds took over, she argued. The only way to reach God, or anyhow the space beyond us where God ought to be, is by working hard, by helping other people, and by pushing your mind to the limit of its capability, and then going a little beyond, and just listening. Beyond logos to mythos. She was always restless, always trying something new. Yet in some ways she was the most contented person I ever met, at least before the incoming showed up. Now, though, she wasn't content about the state of the church's foundations. She showed me where she had dug up flagstones to reveal sodden ground. "We're digging out new drainage channels, but it's a hell of a job. We may end up rebuilding the founds altogether. The very deepest level seems to be wood. Huge piles of Saxon oak." She eyed me. "This church has stood here for 1,000 years, without, apparently, facing a threat such as this before. Some measure of climate change, right?" I shrugged. "I suppose you'd say we arseholes in the environment industry should be concentrating on stuff like this rather than preparing to fight interstellar wars." "Well, so you should. And maybe a more mature species would be preparing for positive outcomes. Think of it, Tobe. There are now creatures in this solar system who are smarter than us. They have to be, or they wouldn't be here, right? Somewhere between us and the angels, who knows what they can tell us? What is their science? Their art? Their theology?" I frowned. "But what do they want? That's what may count from now on. Their agenda, not ours." "There you are being paranoid again." But she hesitated. "What about Merrill and the kids?"
"Merrill's at home. Mark and Sophie at school," I shrugged. "Life is normal."
"Some people are freaking out, raiding the supermarkets."
"Some people always do. We want things to continue as normally as possible, as long as possible. Modern society is efficient, you know, Edith, but not very resilient. A fuel strike could cripple us in a week, let alone alien invaders."
She pushed a loose grey hair back under her hard hat and looked at me suspiciously. "But you seem very calm, considering. You know something, don't you, you bastard?"
I grinned. "And you know me."
"Spill it."
"Two things. We picked up signals, or more likely, leakage. You know about the infrared stuff we've seen for a while coming from the nucleus. Now we've detected radio noise. Faint. Clearly structured. Very complex. It may be some kind of internal channel rather than anything meant for us. But if we can figure anything out from it..."
"Well, that's exciting. And the second thing? Come on, Miller."
"We have more refined trajectory data. All this will be released soon. It's probably leaked already."
"Yes?"
"The incoming are heading for the inner solar system. But they aren't coming here. Not to Earth."
She frowned. "Then where?"
I dropped my bombshell. Venus. Not Earth. They're heading for Venus, Edith. She looked into the clouded sky, the bright patch that marked the position of the sun and the inner planets.
Venus? That's a cloudy hellhole. What would they want there?
I've no idea.
Well, I'm used to living with questions I'll never be able to answer. Let's hope this isn't one of them. In the meantime, let's make ourselves useful.
She eyed my crumpled Whitehall suit, my patent leather shoes already splashed with mud.
Have you got time to stay? You want to help out with my drain? I've a spare overall that might fit.
Talking, speculating, we walked through the church. We used the excuse of Edith's Goonhilly event to make a family trip to Cornwall. We took the A road snaking west down the spine of the Cornish Peninsula and stopped at a small hotel in Helston. The pretty little town was decked out for that day for the annual furry dance, an ancient, eccentric carnival in which the local children would weave in and out of the houses on the hilly streets. The next morning, Merrill was to take the kids to the beach, further up the coast. And just about at dawn, I set off alone in a hired car for the A road to the southeast, towards Goonhilly Down. It was a clear May morning. As I drove, I was aware of Venus rising in the eastern sky and clearly visible in my rearview mirror, a lamp shining steadily even as the day brightened. Goonhilly is a stretch of high open land, a windy place. Its claim to fame is that at one time it hosted the largest telecom satellite Earth station in the world. It picked up the first live transatlantic TV broadcast via Telstar. It was decommissioned years ago, but its oldest dish, a 1,000-ton parabolic bowl called Arthur, after the king, became a listed building, and so was preserved. And that was how it was available for Edith and her committee of messengers to get hold of, when they, or rather she, grew impatient with the government's continuing reticence. Because of the official policy, I had to help with smoothing through the permissions, all behind the scenes. Just after my first glimpse of the surviving dishes on the skyline, I came up against a police cordon, a hastily erected plastic fence that excluded a few groups of chanting shouters and a fundamentalist religious group, protesting that the messengers were communicating with the devil. My ministry card helped me get through. Edith was waiting for me at the old site's visitors' centre, opened up that morning for breakfast, coffee and cereals and toast. Her volunteers cleared up dirty dishes under a big wall screen showing a live feed from a space telescope. The best images available right now, though every major space agency had a probe to Venus in preparation, and NASA had already fired one off. The incoming nucleus, it seemed inappropriate to call that lump of dirty ice a craft, though such it clearly was a brilliant star, too small to show a disk, swinging in its wide orbit above a half-moon Venus. And on the planet's night side, you could clearly make out the patch, the strange, complicated glow in the cloud banks, tracking the incoming's orbit precisely. It was strange to gaze upon that choreography in space, and then to turn to the east and see Venus with the naked eye. And Edith's volunteers, a few dozen earnest men, women, and children who looked like they had gathered for a village show, had the audacity to believe they could speak to these godlike forms in the sky. There was a terrific metallic groan. We turned and saw that Arthur was turning on his concrete pivot. The volunteers cheered, and a general drift towards the monument began. Edith walked with me, cradling a polystyrene teacup in the palms of fingerless gloves.
"I'm glad you could make it down. Should have brought the kids. Some of the locals from Helston are here. They've made the whole stunt part of their furry dance celebration. Did you see the preparations in town? Supposed to celebrate St. Michael beating up on the devil. I wonder how appropriate that symbolism is. Anyhow, this ought to be a fun day. Later there'll be a barn dance."
Merrill thought it was safer to take the kids to the beach, just in case anything gets upsetting here, you know. That was most of the truth. There was a subtext that Merrill had never much enjoyed being in the same room as my ex.
"Probably wise. Our British shouters are a mild bunch, but in rowdier parts of the world there has been trouble.
The loose international coalition of groups called the Shouters was paradoxically named because they campaigned for silence. They argued that shouting in the jungle by sending signals to the incoming, or the Venusians, was taking an irresponsible risk. Of course, they could do nothing about the low-level chatter that had been targeted at the incoming since it had first been sighted nearly a year ago already. Edith waved a hand at Arthur. If I were a shouter, I'd be here today. This will be by far the most powerful message sent from the British Isles. I'd seen and heard roughs of Edith's message. In with a Carl Sagan-style prime number lexicon, there was digitized music from Bach to Zulu chants, and art from cave paintings to Warhol, and images of mankind featuring a lot of smiling children and astronauts on the moon. There was even a copy of the old Pioneer space probe plaque from the 70s, with the smiling naked couple. At least, I thought cynically, all that fluffy stuff would provide a counterpoint to the images of war, murder, famine, plague and other sufferings that the incoming had no doubt sampled by now, if they'd chosen to. I said, but I get the feeling they're just not interested. Neither the incoming nor the Venusians. Sorry to rain on your parade. I take it the cryptolinguists aren't getting anywhere decoding the signals. They're not so much signals as leakage from internal processes, we think. In both cases, the nucleus and the patch. I rubbed my face. I was tired after the previous day's long drive. In the case of the nucleus, some kind of organic chemistry seems to be mediating powerful magnetic fields, and the incoming seem to swarm within. I don't think we've really any idea what's going on in there. We're actually making more progress with the science of the Venusian biosphere. If the arrival of the incoming had been astonishing, the evidence of intelligence on Venus, entirely unexpected, was stunning. Nobody had expected the clouds to part right under the orbiting incoming nucleus. Like a deep storm system, kilometers deep in that thick ocean of an atmosphere. And nobody had expected to see the patch revealed, swirling mist banks where lights flickered tantalizingly, like organized lightning. With retrospect, given the results from the old space probes, we might have guessed there was something on Venus. Life, if not intelligent life. There were always unexplained deficiencies and surpluses of various compounds. We think the Venusians live in the clouds, far enough above the red-hot ground that the temperature is low enough for liquid water to exist. They ingest carbon monoxide and excrete sulfur compounds, living off the sun's ultraviolet.
And they're smart?
Oh, yes. The astronomers already recording the complex signals coming out of the incoming nucleus had started to discern rich patterns in the Venusian patch, too. You can tell how complicated a message is, even if you don't know anything about the content. You measure entropy orders, which are like correlation measures, mapping structures on various scales embedded in the transmission.
You don't understand any of what you just said, do you?
I smiled. Not a word. But I do know this. Going by their data structures, the Venusians are smarter than us, as we are smarter than the chimps. And the incoming are smarter again.
Edith turned to face the sky, the brilliant spark of Venus.
But you say the scientists still believe all this chatter is just... What was your word?
Leakage. Edith, the incoming and the Venusians aren't speaking to us. They aren't even speaking to each other. What we're observing is a kind of internal dialogue in each case. The two are talking to themselves, not each other. One theorist briefed the PM that perhaps both these entities are more like hives than human communities.
Hives?
She looked troubled.
Hives are different. They can be purposeful, but they don't have consciousness as we have it. They aren't finite as we are. Their edges are much more blurred. They aren't even mortal. Individuals can die, but the hives live on.
I wonder what their theology will be then.
It's all so strange. These aliens just don't fit any category we expected, or even that we share. Not mortal, not communicative, and not interested in us. What do they want? What can they want?
Her tone wasn't like her. She sounded bewildered to be facing open questions rather than exhilarated as usual. I tried to reassure her. Maybe your signal will provoke some answers. She checked her watch and looked up again towards Venus.
Well, we've only got 5 minutes to wait before...
Her eyes widened, and she fell silent. I turned to look the way she was, to the east. Venus was flaring, sputtering like a dying candle. People started to react. They shouted, pointed, or they just stood there, staring as I did. I couldn't move. I felt a deep, awed fear. Then people called, pointing at the big screen in the visitor center, where, it seemed, the space telescopes were returning a very strange set of images indeed. Edith's hand crept into mine. Suddenly, I was very glad I hadn't brought my kids that day. I heard angrier shouting and a police siren, and I smelled burning. Once I'd finished making my police statement, I went back to the hotel in Helston, where Merrill was angry and relieved to see me, and the kids bewildered and vaguely frightened. I couldn't believe that after all that had happened, the strange events at Venus, the assaults by shouters on messages and vice versa, the arson, Edith's injury, the police crackdown, it was not yet 11 in the morning. That same day I took the family back to London and called in at work. Then, 3 days after the incident, I got away again and commandeered a ministry car and driver to take me back to Cornwall. Edith was out of intensive care, but she'd been kept in the hospital at Truro. She had a TV stand before her face, the screen dark. I carefully kissed her on the unburnt side of her face and sat down, handing over books, newspapers, and flowers. Thought you might be bored.
You never were any good with the sick, were you, Tobe?
Sorry. I opened up one of the newspapers. But there's some good news. They caught the arsonists. She grunted, her distorted mouth barely opening.
So what? It doesn't matter who they were. Messages and shouters have been at each other's throats all over the world. People like that are interchangeable. But did we all have to behave so badly? I mean, they even wrecked Arthur.
And he was grade 2 listed. She laughed, then regretted it, for she winced with the pain.
But why shouldn't we smash everything up down here? After all, that's all they seem to be interested in up there. The incoming assaulted Venus, and the Venusians struck back. We all saw it, live on TV. It was nothing more than War of the Worlds. She sounded disappointed. These creatures are our superiors, Toby. All your signal analysis stuff proved it. And yet, they haven't transcended war and destruction. But we learned so much.
I had a small briefcase which I opened now, and pulled out printouts that I spread over her bed. The screen images are better, but you know how it is. They won't let me use my laptop or my phone in here. Look, Edith, it was incredible. The incoming assault on Venus lasted hours. Their weapon, whatever it was, burned its way through the patch and right down through an atmosphere 100 times thicker than Earth's. We even glimpsed the surface, now melted to slag. Much of it. But then the acid munchers in the clouds struck back. We think we know what they did. That caught her interest.
How can we know that?
Sheer luck. That NASA probe heading for Venus happened to be in the way. The probe had detected a wash of electromagnetic radiation coming from the planet.
A signal, breathed Edith. Heading which way?
Out from the sun. And then, 8 hours later, the probe sensed another signal coming the other way. I say sensed. It bobbed about like a cork on a pond. We think it was a gravity wave. Very sharply focused. Very intense.
And when the wave hit the incoming nucleus?
Well, you saw the pictures. The last fragments have burned up in Venus's atmosphere. She lay back on her reef of pillows.
8 hours.
She mused.
Gravity waves travel at light speed. 4 hours out, 4 hours back. Earth's about 8 light minutes from the sun. What's 4 light hours out from Venus? Jupiter? Saturn?
Neptune. Neptune was 4 light hours out.
Was?
It's gone, Edith. Almost all of it. The moons are still there, a few chunks of core ice and rock slowly dispersing. The Venusians used the planet to create their gravity wave pulse.
They used it? Are you telling me this to cheer me up? A gas giant, a significant chunk of the solar system's budget of mass energy, sacrificed for a single warlike gesture.
She laughed bitterly.
Oh, God!
Of course, we've no idea how they did it. I put away my images. If we were scared of the incoming, now we're terrified of the Venusians. That NASA probe has been shut down. We don't want anything to look like a threat. You know, I heard the PM herself ask why it was that a space war should break out now, just when we humans are sitting around on Earth. Even politicians know we haven't been here that long.
Edith shook her head, wincing again. The final vanity. This whole episode has never been about us. Can't you see? If this is happening now, it must have happened over and over. Who knows how many other planets we lost in the past, consumed as weapons of forgotten wars? Maybe all we see, the planets and stars and galaxies, is just the debris of huge wars, on and on, up to scales we can barely imagine. And we're just weeds growing in the rubble. Tell that to the Prime Minister. And I thought we might ask them about their gods. What a fool I've been. The questions on which I've wasted my life, and here are my answers. What a fool!
She was growing agitated. Take it easy, Edith.
Oh, just go. I'll be fine. It's the universe that's broken, not me.
She turned away on her pillow, as if to sleep. The next time I saw Edith, she was out of hospital and back at her church. It was another September day. Like the first time I visited her after the incoming appeared in our telescopes, and at least it wasn't raining. There was a bite in the breeze, but I imagined it soothed her damaged skin. And here she was, digging in the mud before her church.
Equinox season, she said. Rain coming, best to get this fixed before we have another flash flood. And before you ask, the doctor's cleared me. It's my face that's buggered, not the rest of me.
I wasn't going to ask.
Okay, then. How's Merrill? The kids?
Fine. Merrill's at work, the kids back at school. Life goes on.
It must, I suppose. What else is there? No, by the way.
No what?
No, I won't come serve on your minister's think tank.
At least consider it.
You'd be ideal.
Look, we're all trying to figure out where we go from here. The arrival of the incoming, the war on Venus, it was like a religious revelation. That's how it's being described, a revelation witnessed by all mankind on TV. Suddenly we've got an entirely different view of the universe out there. And we have to figure out how we go forward, in a whole number of dimensions, political, scientific, economic, social, religious.
I'll tell you how we go forward. In despair. Religions are imploding.
No, they're not.
Okay, theology is imploding. Philosophy. The rest of the world has changed channels and forgotten already, but anybody with any imagination knows. In a way, this has been the final demotion. The end of the process that started with Copernicus and Darwin. Now we know there are creatures in the universe much smarter than we'll ever be. And we know they don't care a damn about us. It's the indifference that's the killer, don't you think? All our futile agitation about if they'd attack us and whether we should signal. And they did nothing but smash each other up. With that above us, what can we do but turn away?
You're not turning away.
She leaned on her shovel. I'm not religious. I don't count.
My congregation turned away.
Here I am.
Alone. She glanced at the clear sky.
Maybe solitude is the key to it all. A galactic isolation imposed by the vast gulfs between the stars, the light speed limit. As a species develops, you might have a brief phase of individuality, of innovation and technological achievement. But then, when the universe gives you nothing back, you turn in on yourself and slide into the milky embrace of eusociality, the hive. But what then? How would it be for a mass mind to emerge alone? Maybe that's why the incoming went to war, because they were outraged to discover, by some chance, they weren't alone in the universe.
Most commentators think it was about resources. Most of our wars are about that in the end.
Yes, depressingly true. All life is based on the destruction of other life, even on tremendous scales of space and time.
Our ancestors understood that right back to the Ice Age and venerated the animals they had to kill.
They were so far above us, the incoming and the Venusians alike. Yet maybe we, at our best, are morally superior to them.
I touched her arm. This is why we need you. For your insights. There's a storm coming, Edith. We're going to have to work together if we're to weather it, I think.
She frowned. What kind of storm? Oh, Neptune.
Yeah. You can't just delete a world without consequences. The planet's orbits are singing like plucked strings. The asteroids and comets, too, and those orphaned moons wandering around, some of the stirred-up debris is falling into the inner system.
And if we're struck?
I shrugged. We'll have to help each other. There's nobody else to help us, that's for sure. Look, Edith, maybe the incoming and the Venusians are typical of what's out there. But that doesn't mean we have to be like them, does it? Maybe we'll find others more like us. And if not, well, we can be the first. A spark to light a fire that will engulf the universe.
She ruminated.
You have to start somewhere, I suppose.
Like this drain.
Well, there you go.
All right, damn it. I'll join your think tank. But first, you're going to help me finish this drain, aren't you, city boy?
So I changed into overalls and work boots, and we dug away at that ditch in the damp, clingy earth until our backs ached, and the light of the equinoctial day slowly faded. The Server and the Dragon. Hannu Rajaniemi. In the beginning, before it was a creator and a dragon, the server was alone. It was born, like all servers were, from a tiny seed fired from a dark ship exploring the big empty, expanding the reach of the network. Its first sensation was the light from the star it was to make its own, the warm and juicy spectrum that woke up the nanologic inside its protein shell. Reaching out, it deployed its braking sail, miles of molecule-thin wires that it spun rigid, and seized the solar wind to steer itself towards the heat. Later, the server remembered its making as a long, slow dream, punctuated by flashes of lucidity, falling through the atmosphere of a gas giant's moon in a fiery streak to splash in a methane sea, unpacking a fierce synth bioreplicator, multicellular crawlers spreading server life to the harsh, rocky shores before dying, providing soil for server plants. Dark flowers reaching for the vast purple and blue orb of the gas giant, sowing seeds in the winds. The slow disassembly of the moon into server makers that sped in all directions, eating, shaping, dreaming the server into being. When the server finally woke up, fully grown, all the mass in the system, apart from the warm, bright flower of the star itself, was an orderly garden of smart matter. The server's body was a fragmented eggshell of Dyson statites, drinking the light of the star. Its mind was diamondoid processing nodes, and smart dust swarms and cold quantum condensates in the system's outer dark. Its eyes were interferometers and WIMP detectors and ghost images. The first thing the server saw was the galaxy. A whirlpool of light in the sky with a lenticular sphere, spiral arms frothed with stars, a halo of dark matter that held nebulae in its grip like fireflies around a lantern. The galaxy was alive with the network, with the blinding, hawking incandescence of hull ships, thundering along their cycles. The soft infrared glow of fully grown servers barely spilling a drop of the heat of their stars. The faint gravity ripples of the dark ship's passage in the void. But the galaxy was 500,000 light-years away, and the only thing the server could hear was the soft, black whisper of the cosmic microwave background, the lonely echo of another birth. It did not take the server long to understand. The galaxy was an N-body chaos of 100 billion stars, not a clockwork, but a beehive. And among the many calm, slow orbits of Einstein and Newton, there were singular ones, like the one of the star that the server had been planted on, shooting out of the galaxy at a considerable fraction of light speed. Why there, whether an indiscriminate seeding of an oversexed dark ship, or to serve some unfathomable purpose of the controller, the server did not know. The server longed to construct virtuals and bodies for travellers, to route packets, to transmit and create and convert and connect. The controller laws were built into every aspect of its being, and not to serve was not to be. And so the server's solitude cut deep. At first, it ran simulations to make sure it was ready if a packet or a signal ever came, testing its systems to full capacity with imagined traffic, routing quantum packets, refueling ghosts of whole ships, decelerating cycler payloads. After a while, it felt empty. This was not true serving, but serving of the self, with a tang of guilt. Then it tried to listen and amplify the faint signals from the galaxy in the sky, but caught only fragments, none of which were meant for it to hear. For millennia, it slowed its mind down, steeling itself to wait. But that only made things worse. The slow time showed the server the full glory of the galaxy alive with the network, the infrared winks of new servers being born, the long arcs of the whole ship's cycles, all the distant travellers who would never come. The server built itself science engines to reinvent all the knowledge a server seed could not carry, patiently rederiving quantum field theory and thread theory and the elusive algebra of emergence. It examined its own mind until it could see how the controller had taken the cognitive architecture from the hominids of the distant past and shaped it for a new purpose. It gingerly played with the idea of splitting itself to create a companion, only to be almost consumed by a suicide urge triggered by a violation of the law. Thou shalt not self-replicate. Ashamed, it turned its gaze outwards. It saw the cosmic web of galaxies and clusters and superclusters and the end of greatness beyond. It mapped the faint fluctuations in the gravitational wave background from which all the structure in the universe came from. It felt the faint pull of the other membrane universes, only millimeters away, but in a direction that was neither X, Y, nor Z. It understood what a rare peak in the landscape of universes its home was, how carefully the fine structure constant and 100 other numbers had been chosen to ensure that stars and galaxies and servers would come to be. And that was when the server had an idea. The server already had the tools it needed. Gigaton gamma-ray lasers it would have used to supply whole ships with fresh singularities, a few pinches of exotic matter painstakingly mined from the Casimir vacuum for dark ships and warships. The rest was all thinking and coordination and time, and the server had more than enough of that. It arranged 100 lasers into a clockwork mechanism, all aimed at a single point in space. It fired them in perfect synchrony. And that was all it took? A concentration of energy dense enough to make the vacuum itself ripple. A fuzzy flower of tangled strings blossomed, grew into a bubble of space-time that expanded into that other direction. The server was ready. firing an exotic matter nugget into the tiny conflagration. And suddenly the server had a tiny, glowing sphere in its grip. A wormhole end. A window to a newborn universe. The server cradled its cosmic child and built an array of instruments around it. Quantum images that fired entangled particles at the wormhole and made pictures from their ghosts. Primordial chaos reigned on the other side, a porridge-like plasma of quarks and gluons. In an eye blink, it clumped into hadrons, almost faster than the server could follow. The baby had its own arrow of time, its own fast heartbeat, young and hungry. And then the last scattering, a birth cry, when light finally had enough room to travel through the baby so the server could see its face. The baby grew. Dark matter ruled its early life, filling it with long filaments and neutralinos and their relatives. Soon, the server knew, matter would accrete around them, condensing into stars and galaxies like raindrops in a spider web. There would be planets, and life would need to be served. The anticipation was a warm heartbeat that made the server's shells ring with joy. Perhaps the server would have been content to cherish and care for its creation forever. But before the baby made any stars, the dragon came. The server almost did not notice the signal. It was faint, redshifted to almost nothing. But it was enough to trigger the servant's instincts. One of its statites glowed with waste heat as it suddenly reassembled itself into the funnel of a vast linear decelerator. The next instant, the data packet came. Massing only a few micrograms, it was a clump of condensed matter with long-lived gauge field knots inside, quantum entangled with a counterpart 500,000 light-years away. The packet hurtled into the funnel almost at the speed of light. As gently as it could, the server brought the traveller to a halt with electromagnetic fields and fed it to the quantum teleportation system, unused for countless millennia. The carrier signal followed, and guided by it, the server performed a delicate series of measurements and logic gate operations on the packet's state vector. From the marriage of entanglement and carrier wave, a flood of data was born, thick and heavy, a specification for a virtual, rich in simulated physics. With infinite gentleness, the server decanted the virtual into its data processing nodes and initialized it. Immediately, the virtual was seething with activity, but tempted as it was, the server did not look inside. Instead, it wrapped its mind around the virtual, listening at every interface, ready to satisfy its every need. Distantly, the server was aware of the umbilical of its baby. But through its happy servitude trance, it hardly noticed that nucleosynthesis had begun in the young, expanding firmament, producing hydrogen and helium, building blocks of stars. Instead, the server wondered who the travellers inside the virtual were and where they were going. It hungered to know more of the network and its brothers and sisters and the mysterious ways of the dark ships and the controller. But for a long time, the virtual was silent, growing and unpacking its data silently, like an egg. At first, the server thought it imagined the request, but the long millennia alone had taught it to distinguish the phantoms of solitude from reality. A call for a sysadmin from within. The server entered through one of the spawning points of the virtual. The operating system did not grant the server its usual omniscience, and it felt small. Its bodiless viewpoint saw a yellow sun, much gentler than the server star's incandescent blue, and a landscape of clouds, the hue of royal purple and gold, with peaks of dark, craggy mountains far below. But the call that the server had heard came from above. A strange being struggled against the boundaries of gravity and air, hurling herself upwards towards the blackness beyond the blue, wings slicing the thinning air furiously, a fire flaring in her mouth. She was a long, sinuous creature with mirror scales and eyes of dark emerald. Her wings had patterns that reminded the server of the baby, a web of dark and light. The virtual told the server she was called a dragon. Again and again and again she flew upwards and fell, crying out in frustration. That was what the server had heard, through the interfaces of the virtual. It watched the dragon in astonishment. Here, at least, was an other. The server had a million questions, but first it had to serve.
How can I help? The server asked. What do you need?
The dragon stopped in midair, almost fell, then righted itself.
Who are you? It asked.
This was the first time anyone had ever addressed the server directly, and it took a moment to gather the courage to reply.
I am the server, the server said.
Where are you? The dragon asked.
I am everywhere.
How delightful, the dragon said. Did you make the sky?
Yes, I made everything.
It is too small, the dragon said. I want to go higher. Make it bigger. It swished its tail back and forth.
I am sorry, the server said. I cannot alter the specification. It is the law.
But I want to see, she said. I want to know. I have danced all the dances below. What is above? What is beyond?
I am, the server said. Everything else is far, far away.
The dragon hissed its disappointment. It dove down into the clouds, an angry silver shape against the dark hues.
It was the most beautiful thing the server had ever seen.
The dragon's sudden absence made the server's whole being feel hollow. And just as the server was about to withdraw its presence, the demands of the law too insistent, the dragon turned back.
All right, it said, tongue flicking in the thin, cold air. I suppose you can tell me instead.
Tell you what? The server asked.
Tell me everything.
After that, the dragon called the server to the place where the sky ended many times. They told each other stories. The server spoke about the universe and the stars and the echoes of the Big Bang in the dark. The dragon listened and swished its tail back and forth and talked about her dances in the wind and the dreams she dreamed in her cave alone. None of this the server understood, but listened anyway. The server asked where the dragon came from, but she could not say. She knew only that the world was a dream, and one day she would awake. In the meantime, there was flight and dance, and what else did she need? The server asked why the virtual was so big for a single dragon, and the dragon hissed and said that it was not big enough. The server knew well that the dragon was not what she seemed, that it was a shell of software around a kernel of consciousness. But the server did not care, nor did it miss or think of its baby universe beyond the virtual sky. And little by little, the server told the dragon how it came to be.
Why did you not leave? Asked the dragon. You could have grown wings. You could have flown to your little star pool in the sky.
It is against the law, the server said. Forbidden. I was only made to serve. And I cannot change.
How peculiar, said the dragon. I serve no one. Every day I change. Every year I shed our skin. Is it not delightful how different we are?
The server admitted that it saw the symmetry.
I think it would do you good, said the dragon, to be a dragon for a while.
At first the server hesitated. Strictly speaking, it was not forbidden. The law allowed the server to create avatars if it needed them to repair or to serve. But the real reason it hesitated was that it was not sure what the dragon would think. It was so graceful, and the server had no experience of embodied life. But in the end, it could not resist. Only for a short while, it told itself, checking its systems and saying goodbye to the baby, warming its quantum fingers in the hawking glow of the first black holes of the little universe. The server made itself a body with the help of the dragon. It was a mirror image of its friend, but water where the dragon was fire. a flowing green form that was like a living whirlpool stretched out in the sky. When the server poured itself into the dragon shape, it cried out in pain. It was used to latency, to feeling the world via instruments from far away, but this was a different kind of birth from what it knew. A sudden, acute awareness of muscles and flesh and the light and the air on its scales and the overpowering scent of the silver dragon, like sweet gunpowder. The server was clumsy at first, just as it had feared. But the dragon only laughed when the server tumbled around in the sky, showing how to use her wings. For the little dragon had chosen a female gender for the server. When the server asked why, the dragon said it had felt right. "You think too much," she said. "That's why you can't dance. Flying is not thought. Flying is flying." They played a hide-and-seek game in the clouds until the server could use her wings better. Then they set out to explore the world. They skirted the slopes of the mountains, wreathed in summer, explored deep crags where red fires burned. They rested on a high peak, looking at the sunset. "I need to go soon," the server said, remembering the baby. "If you go, I will be gone," the dragon said. "I change quickly. It is almost time for me to shed my skin." The setting sun turned the cloudlands red above. The imaginary stars of the virtual winked into being. "Look around," the dragon said. "If you can contain all this within yourself, is there anything you can't do? You should not be so afraid." "I am not afraid anymore," the server said. "Then it is time to show you my cave," the dragon said. In the dragon's cave, deep beneath the earth, they made love. It was like flying, and yet not. But there was the same loss of self in a flurry of wings and fluids and tongues and soft folds and teasing claws. The server drank in the hot, sharp taste of the dragon and let herself be touched until the heat building up within her body seemed to burn through the fabric of the virtual itself. And when the explosion came, it was a birth and a death at the same time. Afterwards, they lay together, wrapped around each other so tightly that it was hard to tell where the server ended and the dragon began. She would have been content, except for a strange, hollow feeling in its belly. She asked the dragon what it was. "That is hunger," the dragon said. There was a sad note to its slow, exhausted breathing. "How curious," the server said, eager for a new sensation. "What do dragons eat?" "We eat servers," the dragon said. Her teeth glistened in the red glow of her throat. The virtual dissolved into raw code around them. The server tore the focus of its consciousness away, but it was too late. The thing that had been the dragon had already bitten deep into its mind. The virtual exploded outwards, software tendrils reaching into everything that the server was. It waged a war against itself, turning its gamma-ray lasers against the infected components and Dyson statites. But the dragon thing grew too fast, taking over the server's processing nodes, making copies of itself in uncountable billions. The server's quantum packet launchers rained dragons towards the distant sky. The remaining dragon code ate its own tail, self-destructing, consuming the server's infrastructure with it, leaving only a whisper in the server's mind, like a discarded skin. "Thank you for the new sky," it said. That was when the server remembered the baby. The baby was sick. The server had been gone too long. The baby universe's vacuum was infected with dark energy. It was pulling itself apart towards a big rip, an expansion of space-time so rapid that every particle would end up alone inside its own light cone, never interacting with another. No stars, galaxies, nor life. A heat death, not with a whimper or a bang, but a rapid, cruel tearing. It was the most terrible thing the server could imagine. It felt its battered, broken body, scattered and dying across the solar system. The guilt and the memories of the dragon were pale and poisonous in its mind, a corruption of serving itself. Is it not delightful how different we are? The memory struck a spark in the server's dying science engines. An idea. A hope. The vacuum of the baby was not stable. The dark energy that drove the baby's painful expansion was the product of a local minimum. And in the landscape of vacua, there was something else. More symmetric. It took the last of the server's resources to align the gamma ray lasers. They burned out as the server lit them. A cascade of little novae. Their radiation tore at what remained of the server's mind, but it did not care. The wormhole end glowed. On the other side, the baby's vacuum shook and bubbled, and just a tiny nugget of it changed. A supersymmetric vacuum in which every boson had a fermionic partner, and vice versa, where nothing was alone. It spread through the flesh of the baby universe at the speed of light, like the thought of a god changing everything. In the new vacuum, dark energy was not a mad giant tearing things apart, just a gentle pressure against the collapsing force of gravity. A balance. But supersymmetry could not coexist with the server's broken vacuum. A boundary formed. A domain wall erupted within the wormhole end like a flaw in a crystal. Just before the defect sealed the umbilical, the server saw the light of first stars on the other side. In the end, the server was alone. It was blind now, barely more than a thought in a broken statite fragment. How easy it would be, it thought, to dive into the bright heart of its star and burn away. But the law would not allow it to pass. It examined itself, just as it had millennia before, looking for a way out. And there, in its code, a smell of gunpowder. A change. The thing that was no longer the server shed its skin. It opened bright light sails around the star. A scarred-off necklace that took the star's radiation and turned it into thrust. And slowly, at first as if in a dream, then gracefully as a dragon, the traveller began to move.